can't stop coming.
Because there's
okay.
Nothing like live.
There's nothing like live.
There's nothing like live.
Okay, the Battle of Bentonville, North Carolina, was fought as part of the Carolinas campaign of the Civil War. It was the last battle between the armies of Union Major General William Sherman and Confederate General Joseph E. Johnston. While General Sherman assumed that rebel forces in the Carolinas were too widely dispersed to offer any significant resistance, General Johnston had assembled 17,000 troops and was soon attacking one of Sherman's wings at Bentonville. The rest of the story will be the focus tonight of our speaker, who is Daniel T. Davis, a managing editor and chief historian of the blog Emergent Civil War. As Rob mentioned, he's a graduate of Longwood University and has a BA in public history. Dan has worked as a historian at both Appomattox Courthouse and also at Fredericksburg, Spotsylvania National Military Park. He resides in Fredericksburg with his wonderful wife, Katie, who's accompanying him this evening. Together with Philip Greenwald, he is a co-author of Bloody Autumn, the Shenandoah Valley Campaign of 1864, and Hurricane from the Heavens, the Battle of Cold Harbor. Let's give Daniel a big welcome.
Good evening.
Good evening. Good evening.
There we go. It was Christmas Eve in 1864 in Savannah, Georgia. And in the Charles Green House, Major General William Tecumseh Sherman was busy writing letters. Now, one of those letters that he wrote that evening was to General-in-Chief, Lieutenant General Ulysses S. Grant. And Sherman had just completed his famous march to the sea from Atlanta to Savannah. And he was contemplating his next movement. And Sherman proposed a plan to Grant that he would take his army group, two armies of roughly about 60,000 men, northward through the Carolinas in the dead of winter, cut off from supplies. And Sherman wished that this next march would cut off and devastate southern logistics in those states, as well as to continue to dishearten the southern populace whose morale and willingness to go on with the war was beginning to wane. Grant approved of the plan, and on February the 1st, Sherman was delayed by weather. His army group set off from Savannah. He had two armies, the Army of Georgia, commanded by Major General Henry Slocum, and the Army of the Tennessee, commanded by Major General Oliver Otis Howard. Now, the plan for the march to the Carolinas was quite simple. The two armies would move along separate roads, roughly about 10 miles apart. And this gave Sherman somewhat of an advantage over the Confederates. One, it allowed the Federals to move over a vast area from which they could draw supplies. And it also allowed them to deceive the enemy as to where their actual destination was by moving, again, the two columns in two different directions on separate roads. But there was a couple of drawbacks to this plan. The first drawback being that the two columns would be marching separated by a distance of give or take 10 to 12 miles, leaving them isolated and thus vulnerable to an attack. any type of major attack would delay the march, and a delay was something that Sherman wanted to avoid at all cost. Because if his army was delayed and forced to spend an extended period in a given place or area, they would begin to run out of food. So in short, when Sherman left Savannah in February of 1865, one of his major objectives for the campaign was in fact not to fight a major battle. When I learned that Sherman's armies was marching through the Salcahatchie Swamps, recalled Confederate General Joseph Johnston after the war, making its own corduroy road at the rate of a dozen miles a day or more, and bringing its artillery and wagons with it, I made up my mind that there had been no such army in existence since the days of Julius Caesar. Johnston was not the only one to take note of Sherman's movement.
Okay.
I think we are too. Is that better?
Yes.
A little bit better?
Better.
Sorry about that.
Oh, it's all right. As I mentioned, Johnston's not the only one to notice Sherman's movements. One person in particular who's also keeping close tabs on Sherman's march is General Robert E. Lee. Lee knows that if Sherman's armies reach Virginia and they join up with Grant's armies outside Richmond and Petersburg, he's going to face an army some three times the size of his own. Lee knows that he cannot stop Sherman. He doesn't have the manpower to do it. But what he hopes to do is to delay Sherman's advance, buy himself time on the battlefield. And the person that Lee turns to delay Sherman is this man, Joseph Johnston. Johnston had been sent home the previous summer during the Atlanta campaign in disgrace, relieved of command. He's in semi-exile. But Lee will write to President Jefferson Davis that he believes that Johnston is the only man who has the confidence of the people and of the army. Johnston's task is to delay Sherman's advance, and it's a monumental task. Johnston is coming back to command, and he doesn't have an army to command. He's going to end up drawing Confederate forces that are going to make up his hodgepodge army. William Hardy's garrison troops from Charleston are going to be part of that command. So will Robert Hoke and Braxton Bragg's men who have been defending Wilmington, Fort Fisher, along the North Carolina coast. But Johnston's also going to call upon his old command. And he's going to bring the old Army of Tennessee, the principal Confederate army in the Western Theater, in from Mississippi. And Johnston's hope is that at some point he can combine these forces and strike at one of Sherman's wings. Now, by the second week in March, Sherman's armies have reached Fayetteville, North Carolina. And Sherman is planning to resupply his armies at Goldsboro, North Carolina. Goldsboro is a rail junction. The Union Navy can unload supplies on rail cars, bring them inland. Goldsboro is just a few days' march away from Fayetteville. But the day after Sherman leaves Fayetteville, he's going to run in. He's going to run into Lieutenant General William Joseph Hardy's corps. Hardy is a military scholar, if you will. He has authored a manual on tactics prior to the war. And at the battle of what becomes the Battle of Averysboro, Hardy's going to deploy a tactic that Daniel Morgan used at the Battle of Cowpens during the American Revolution. He's going to employ what is known as a defense in depth. And for an entire day, Hardy is going to hold up the advance, one of Sherman's wings, the Army of Georgia, under Henry Slocum. And that's a very important day because it's going to buy time. It's going to buy Joseph Johnston a full day from which he can consolidate his forces in North Carolina and hopefully launch an attack on Sherman's columns. J- Johnson's going to choose the town of Smithfield for this consolidation. Smithfield's roughly about a 30-minute drive from Raleigh, North Carolina. Now, as Johnson is beginning to consolidate his forces, this gentleman is keeping a close eye on Henry Slocum's advance. It's Wade Hampton. Wade Hampton, I think, is one of the better, if not considered the best, Confederate cavalrymen to come out of the American Civil War. Hampton is not a West Pointer. He learns in the field. But he has a wonderful tutor in Jeb Stuart. And under Stuart, Hampton is going to acquire a knack for reconnaissance as well as an eye for terrain. If you're familiar with the Army of Northern Virginia, Wade Hampton spent much of the war fighting in Virginia. But in January of 1865, he's going to come south. He's from South Carolina. He's going to return to his native state in the hopes of defending it against Sherman's armies. And he brings his division down from the Army of Northern Virginia to join Johnson's army. Now, Hampton is operating in an area that's about 16 miles or so south of Smithfield. He's operating here near the village of Bentonville. And although you can't see it on the map, Hampton is starting to consolidate his forces here in this area. It's not on the map, but it's near the plantation. It's near the plantation of a fellow named J.J. Cole. And I mentioned the eye for terrain that Hampton has acquired. There's a couple of things that he notices about Cole's plantation. One, it's near the intersection of the main road from Smithfield that intersects with the main road that Slocum has to take to get to Goldsboro. What Hampton also notices about Mr. Cole's plantation is that the ground north of the plantation actually slopes away from the Goldsboro Road, the road that Slocum is bringing his men down. And not only does it slope away from the road, but it flattens off into a plateau. The plateau is heavily wooded. So Hampton takes a look at the ground around the J.J. Cole house, and he pitches a plan to Johnston. He tells Johnston that he can bring men down from Smithfield to the Cole plantation and put them across the Goldsboro Road, Slocum's line of advance, and block the Union advance to Goldsboro. And not only can he do that, but he can assemble a large attacking force on that plateau on this plateau, undercover, to assail the Union column as it marches by and below them on the Goldsboro Road. Johnson likes the plan, and he approves it. And early in the morning of March 19th, Hampton is going to send out this gentleman, George DeBrill, with his cavalry, out along the Goldsboro Road to delay Slocum's advance. DeBrill's men are going to engage Slocum's advance, and they're going to heavily contest it.
Want me to operate this slide?
Yes, please. I just got one more. There we go. Thank you.
It's torture. Water charge.
So DeBrille is going to slowly delay Slocum's advance along the Goldsboro Road throughout the morning of March 19th. If you actually go to the next slide, go forward one more. And as DeBrille is delaying Slocum's advance along the Goldsboro Road, Johnston's putting his troops into position astride the road and to the north on that plateau of the coal plantation. Curiously, as the morning goes along, DeBrille's continuing to delay the Union advance. Braxton Bragg, who's taken up a position south of the road, is going to ask for reinforcements from Hardee's corps to be sent to reinforce the left end of the Confederate line. Bragg's going to take a full division away from Hardee, men who could or would have been used in the attack that Johnston is planning. Now, as the Federals reach the western outskirts of the coal plantation, the Confederate resistance starts to stiffen. So much so that Slocum is forced to deploy two divisions, division of William Carlin, division of James Morgan, north and south of the road, respectively, to try to drive off the Confederate cavalry. Carlin and Morgan actually run up against the Confederate infantry. There's some sharp skirmishing before the Confederates actually push the Federals back. Can you go back one more? Now, as the Army of Tennessee is coming onto the field on the coal plantation, they're preparing for the assault. They're building these earthworks. If you've ever been to Bentonville, I highly recommend that you go see the Army of Tennessee earthworks. As you can see there, they still contain the original log revetments built there by the soldiers prior to their attack on March 19th. It is an incredible experience. I tell you that from my own personal experience. If you have a Civil War bucket list, put Bentonville on your Civil War bucket list. Can you go forward one?
Thank you.
As the morning goes along, and as Carlin and Morgan deploy their men, a strange incident happens. Confederate prisoner is brought to Henry Slocum's headquarters. This prisoner, this soldier dressed in gray, is what we call a galvanized Yankee. He's a Union soldier who'd been captured earlier in the campaign, and rather than languishing in a Confederate prison toward the end of the war, he has decided to enlist in the Confederate Army. But he escapes. He leaves the Confederate lines. And he tells Slocum a very interesting piece of news. He tells Slocum that Johnston has roughly about 20,000 men on the field, and he's girding for an attack. Slocum is a little bit hesitant to believe the man's story. The man tells him that he's from Syracuse, New York. Slocum's from Syracuse, New York. But moreover, one of Slocum's staff officers recognizes the man as a neighbor from back home. And this news galvanizes Henry Slocum to action. Slocum, up to that point in time, didn't really have a good idea about what he was facing on his front. All he knew was that he was driving Confederate cavalry back along the Goldsboro Road. So Slocum's going to send word to the Army of the Tennessee and William Tecumseh Sherman. They're marching roughly on a parallel line off the map, about 6-7 miles below the Army of Georgia. And Slocum's going to send for reinforcements. But he knows it's going to be a full day, at least a full day, before Sherman, Howard, and the Army of the Tennessee can reach the field. He's going to be on his own that day. Around 2:45, Johnston is going to launch this attack, his assault. The assault's going to be launched by the remnants of the Army of Tennessee. This will be their last grand assault. The Army of the Tennessee's ranks had been withered the previous winter during John Bell Hood's Tennessee campaign. They had sustained devastating casualties at Franklin and Nashville. This will be their last attack of the war. Watching somewhere along the Goldsboro Road, a North Carolinian is going to write after the war that as the Confederates stepped out of the tree line, that it looked like a picture and at our distance was truly beautiful. Several officers led the charge on horseback across an open field in full view, with colors flying and the line of battle in such perfect order. It was gallantly done, but it was painful to see how close their battle flags were together, regiments being scarcely larger than companies, and the division not much larger than a regiment should be. The Army of Tennessee is, as one Union officer going to, is going to write after the battle, "Come down on us." They are going to crash into Carlin's division. One Union soldier that he said after the war that he and his comrades ran like the deuce. Carlin's division is going to collapse. Those Confederates are going to continue forward to the Goldsboro Road, and they're going to start looping in to Morgan's rear. Now, interestingly enough, as the Army of Tennessee has launched their assault, Robert Hoke and Braxton Bragg have remained stagnant. They haven't moved. They've watched this attack take place. They hold back, and sometime after Carlin's division breaks, they finally launch their assault. Morgan's men have had all morning to entrench, are ready for them. They quickly press back Hoke and Bragg, but then they realized that they have Confederate infantry coming down into their behind their lines. They're about to be cut off and surrounded by the Confederate forces. There are men who have stood on the parapet, stood on the earthwork, fired out into the Confederates in front of them, only to jump over to the other side of the earthwork and fire back into their rear. Several regiments actually countercharge. They launch a counterattack back into their rear, back in the opposite direction that their earthworks are facing. Their regiments are from New York and Michigan, and they actually push the Confederates back. But much more importantly is that those Confederates south of the road are eventually going to be met by more Union troops coming up and deploying from the rear. Slocum's hurrying as many units as he can forward to try to assemble a new line after Carlin's line has collapsed. You know, the next slide, please. And Slocum's going to form that line on the Reddick Morris farm. And all throughout the afternoon and into the evening hours, the Army of the Tennessee is going to continue launching their assaults on this line. The men who are manning this line are from the 20th Corps. The 20th Corps is the old 12th Corps from the Army of the Potomac. These are veterans from Chancellorsville, veterans of Gettysburg, who are turning back these Confederate assaults. Darkness is going to bring an end to the fighting, and Johnston is eventually going to pull back to the line that he had originally occupied prior to the attack. Those entrenchments that I showed you earlier along the J.J. Cole plantation. Now the morning, next slide please. Now the morning of March the 20th is going to open with the Army of the Tennessee approaching the battlefield, actually from the east. Once again, Confederate cavalry is going to be out in front delaying the Union infantry advance. The Confederate cavalry is commanded by a fellow named Evander McIver Law. Law is a veteran of Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia. But Law is going to buy just enough time to send word back to Joseph Johnston that the Army of the Tennessee is approaching the field. So Johnston is going to decide that he's going to swing his line back and create what is known as a salient. A salient is essentially a bulge in the line, a part of a line that can be attacked from three separate sides. Can I get a show of hands, please, for folks who have been to the Spotsylvania Courthouse battlefield and have walked the Mule Shoe Salient? That's a lot of people. That's essentially Johnston's line, his new line at Bentonville, essentially resembles the Mule Shoe Salient at Spotsylvania. By the time that Sherman arrives and makes contact with Slocum later on in the day, Sherman's going to have about 60,000 men to put into the field against Johnston's 20,000. Johnston's outnumbered. Not only is he outnumbered, but he's at a disadvantage in the line that he occupies. Many historians have criticized Johnston's decision to stay on the field on the second day at Bentonville. Johnson's going to write in his official report after the battle that he did it for two reasons. One, he was hoping that Sherman maybe, just maybe, would attack. He'd have a situation similar to what Johnson faced Sherman at Kennesaw Mountain the previous July during the Atlanta campaign, with federal troops attacking entrenched Confederate positions. But the second thing, the second reason that Johnson gives, is that he wants to try to evacuate his wounded from the battlefield. Very noble sentiment. But a lot of his wounded are not being evacuated back to the Confederate lines. You can go to the next slide. They're being taken to the home of John and Amy Harper behind the Union lines. Now, during the fighting the previous day, the 14th Corps from the Army of Georgia had set up their field hospital on the Reddick Morris Farm. But as the Confederate attacks continued throughout the day and into the afternoon, the Reddick Morris Farm started taking fire. So the chief surgeon of the 14th Corps, a fellow named Waldo Daniels, decided to move the hospital back to this house here. It's much better protected, farther away from the battle lines. And he's going to displace John and Amy Harper and their family. John and Amy Harper are going to stay in the house during the fighting. They're going to move upstairs. And Daniels is going to move his hospital into the first floor of the home. Next slide, please. Early in the morning of March 21st, the two armies are still facing one another. There's been heavy skirmishing throughout the previous afternoon and into the next morning. Sherman is content to just sit tight and wait for Johnston to do something. Again, Sherman does not want to bring on a general battle. But unfortunately for Sherman, the battlefield situation is going to be turned upside down late in the morning. Next slide. This is Major General Joseph Anthony Maurer. Maurer is a division commander in the Army of the Tennessee. He's a veteran in the Mississippi Valley campaigns, of Corinth, Vicksburg, and the Red River campaigns. He is considered to be Sherman's most aggressive division commander. There is an understanding amongst the staff officers in the Army of the Tennessee that if you are assigned to Maurer's staff, you better have your will prepared. Maurer was always out on the front lines, not necessarily the place where you want a division commander to be. And the life expectancy of an officer on Maurer's staff was very, very low. Maurer receives permission late in the morning from his corps commander, Frank Blair, to launch a reconnaissance in force. Maurer has three brigades in his division. He takes two of them, two-thirds of his men, on this quote-unquote reconnaissance in force. I don't think that's a reconnaissance in force. I think Maurer's out looking for a fight. You go to the next slide. So Maurer is going to bring his division off to the Confederate right. He's going to send his brigades forward and to the very thin, off the Union right. He's going to send them in to the Confederate left flank. The Confederate left flank is defended by the cavalry and some infantry. Johnson's lines are too far strung out. There's not enough men to take up the space here in front of Maurer's attack. Maurer's men are going to crash into the Confederate left, and the line is going to completely collapse. Maurer is going to ride within sight of the village of Bentonville. Just beyond Bentonville is the Mill Creek Bridge. This bridge is Johnson's lifeline. This is his only line of retreat. If Maurer can take that bridge, Johnson's army is going to be trapped beneath Mill Creek and between the two wings of Sherman's armies. But Maurer hesitates. He receives word from one of his brigade commanders that he has moved too far out in front of the Union line, and his left does not connect with the right of the Union line. So Maurer is going to start moving his brigades back to make contact with the right of the Union line. And as he does this, as he makes this maneuver, this sidestep, if you will, to his left, It gives the Confederates just enough time to counterattack. Johnston, whose headquarters has actually been overrun by Mauer's attack, Johnston has had to scurry away on foot with his staff, leaving all of his belongings and horses behind, has sent out word to his infantry commanders to come quick. Johnston recognizes the situation is dire, and the Confederates are going to begin launching counterattacks, piecemeal attacks that are going to start to hit Mauer's brigades and push them back toward the Union line. They're actually, the Confederates, the mixed force of infantry and cavalry, are actually going to press in on Mauer from three different directions. Mauer is eventually going to receive orders from William Tecumseh Sherman to break off the fight and return to the Union lines, which he does. You know, the next slide. Mauer's assault shows Johnston that he's finally overstayed his welcome at Bentonville. It's time to go. He's been nearly cut off. He's been nearly surrounded. So beginning late on the night of March 21st and into the 22nd, the Confederates withdraw back across Mill Creek and head for safety. William Tecumseh Sherman is only too happy to see them go, because he heads his infantry columns east, and 2 days after the end of the battle, marches into Goldsboro to finally end his grand march through the Carolinas and to get those supplies that he so desperately needed and wanted. After the war, an officer in the 2nd Massachusetts, who had repulsed the Confederate attacks on the Reddick Morris farm on the first day of the battle, wrote that Bentonville was a series of mistakes, miscarriages, and hard fighting. I think that's a very apt description for the commanders on both sides. It begins on the first day. We have our first miscarriage. The detachment of Lafayette McClaws' division to Braxton Bragg. Wade Hampton, the Confederate cavalryman, would write after the war that that detachment was the only major mistake made by the Confederates during that battle. McClaws, as well as the rest of Hoke and Bragg's command, are going to sit idly by as the Army of Tennessee makes their last assault. They're going to take precious numbers away from the attack that may very well have collapsed James Morgan's division. And that could have very well led to disaster for Henry Slocum. Slocum would have faced an unenviable situation of having two divisions running for the rear and slamming back into his men still in column on the road. But again, that quote from the Massachusetts officer also applies to the Federals. William Tecumseh Sherman was adamant about not fighting a battle during his march through the Carolinas. He was so adamant and so driven by this thought that he let a great opportunity slip by. He pulled Mauer back, Joseph Mauer's assault, at the worst possible moment. Rather than sending more troops in after Mauer to take the Mill Creek Bridge and trap Johnston's army. Sherman, interestingly, would write in his memoirs that Mauer's actions that day were rash. But in the very next paragraph, he writes that he regrets the fact of not having pushed the attack home. The largest battle fought in North Carolina would be overshadowed in the near future. Bentonville was fought March 19th to the 21st of 1865. And just a week or so later, Petersburg and Richmond are going to fall. And on April 9th, Robert E. Lee is going to surrender the Army of Northern Virginia at Appomattox Courthouse. Bentonville is lost in the euphoria of victory. But fortunately for us, for the historians, the students, and the scholars today, This was the last battle that many of these men fought. And that means that it's the freshest in their minds when they sit down after the war to write their memoirs, to write letters, write their official reports. The volume of official reports on this battle is actually quite detailed, given the fact that the battle took place near what would become the end of the war. And we are today quickly approaching, the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Bentonville. If you've never been to the battlefield, it looks much as it did in 1865. The state of North Carolina owns, I would say, between 75 and 80% of the battlefield. The Civil War Trust owns a little over 1,700 acres. It is still an agricultural area. If you go down there during the summertime, you'll see tobacco and cotton growing on the battlefield. We don't get to say that about many of the battlefields in Virginia, unfortunately. You can still go to the Army of Tennessee earthworks. You can follow their attack in on Carlin's division on the first day. And you can, for the most part, follow Maurer's division in on their attack on the last day. And I would absolutely encourage you to do that if you ever have the opportunity. Because the men who fought there, 150 years later, we're standing on their shoulders. I would like to thank you all for having me up here this evening. I'd like to thank Mark, as well as Rob. And I'd be more than happy to answer any of your questions.
Numbers that Davis faced, and how many were in his war, was it?
Jefferson Davis?
Yeah.
Jefferson Columbus Davis.
C.
Yes.
C.
Jefferson C. Davis. He has maybe about 10,000 to 15,000. Numbers for the Army of Tennessee, it's hard to, it depends on which account you read. Davis has about 10,000, 15,000 men. Army of Tennessee at that time, they have 4,000, 4,500, no more than 5,000. The Federals are completely and utterly surprised. Yes, sir.
What was Braxton Bragg's function and role this time? He'd been the command, the advisor to the Jefferson Davis.
Correct. Yeah, he is relieved of command after Chattanooga. William Hardy is put in command after Chattanooga, which is kind of interesting because you have an army on the field at Bentonville in the Army of Tennessee where three of its former commanders are actually on the field there with it, mm-hmm. Johnston, Hardy, and Bragg. Bragg is a military advisor for Jefferson Davis. He is actually assigned, or he goes as Davis's eyes and ears to the Wilmington defenses in Fort Fisher, Department of North Carolina early in 1865. And he's there as an advisor to Robert Hoke, if you will. The two don't get along, needless to say. Unfortunately, and based on his actions, we don't really have to wonder why, but Braxton Bragg never filed an official report for this battle. Mm. So, yes, sir.
What difference would it have made if Sherman had pressed Maurer?
Mill Creek Bridge may have well been taken. It's quite an interesting scenario if you stop and think about it. Because the village of Bentonville, if you go to there today, it's just several houses. There were several houses there at the time of the war. Maurer actually has one of his regiments, the 64th Illinois. and I laugh at this. They're out on the skirmish line. They're the first to go in. They overrun Johnson's headquarters. And they actually get into the town. And they're running about the town, not knowing what to do. And the Mill Creek Bridge is a couple hundred yards away. And then Maurer has to pull them back. Maurer pulls them back, and then the Confederate, as they're beginning to withdraw, Confederate counterattacks start. And that precipitates their retreat. Yep.
The point is that after the battle, Johnson basically told Lee, I can't do anything. I mean, them, right? There's not nothing I can do to stop
right.
Sherman.
Absolutely.
If he'd been destroyed, nothing could have done to stop Sherman either. So I mean, the point is in Sherman's defense, what difference did it make?
His men are hungry. They're running out of food. Sherman writes in his memoirs that by March 21st, the wagons were practically empty of food. They need to get to Goldsboro. Johnston fortunately hits them at the end of the march when they're the most vulnerable. They don't have any food. And that's why Sherman draws Mauer's attack back.
Was Sherman aware that his... I'm going to say three wings, because I'm thinking also of Schofield's approach, mm-hmm. coming from out of New Bern,
yep.
Also heading toward Goldsboro, mm-hmm. from the east. Was Sherman aware, after Averysboro, why does he keep letting Slocum advance because after Howard has been slowed up by a day?
Howard continues on. That's an interesting point. Howard and the Army of the Tennessee do not fight at Averysboro. They are unaffected whatsoever by the battle. It's just Slocum's corps. And even then, it's part of Slocum's army. Apologize. So just part of Slocum's army. Sherman is in contact. He actually makes contact when he reaches Fayetteville with Alfred Terry. And so he knows that Schofield is going to be closing in on Goldsboro. He knows where Terry is. That really answered the question, or...
I would have thought that there would, you know, be sufficient cavalry coverage between the columns that, you know, that they would at least have some communication.
You just hit it. You just hit the nail on the head, something I did not get a chance to talk about, but a very interesting aspect about this battle. Where's the cavalry? Where's Judson Kilpatrick? Kilpatrick is with Henry Slocum's Army of Georgia. He's at the rear of the column. That doesn't make any sense. Cavalry should be out in front. They should be out in front screening and picketing. Kilpatrick has gotten into Sherman's doghouse for the Battle of Averysboro. He has failed to see through Hardee's screen during the battle. He's also still licking his wounds from Battle of Munro's Crossroads, which took place a few days later, where Hampton actually surprises Kilpatrick very early in the morning. The battle is known as Kilpatrick's Shirt Tail Skedaddle, as Kilpatrick is forced to run out of his headquarters on foot in his nightshirt. Federals eventually retake their camps, but the fact that Kilpatrick was surprised by the enemy cavalry, the fact that he wasn't able to break through the screen at Averysboro, has put him at the rear of the column. Had Kilpatrick been out in front, he may have been able to more quickly detect the concentration that Johnston was putting in the field at Bentonville. He's got, Army of Georgia has infantry mounted on mules and horses out in front. Kilpatrick's absence is a huge part of this battle, but it's also probably a huge part of why the Federals nearly met disaster on the first day.
Could you comment also on have the two battles very close together, Averysboro and Bentonville.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, lost in the shuffle is Schofield's approach from New Bern.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'd like to hear your take on the engagement at...
Wise Fork?
Wise Fork, yeah.
Wise Fork is an interesting engagement. It's fought as Schofield is moving his men in from New Bern. They run up against Robert Hoke and Braxton Bragg. Braxton Bragg, unfortunately, is going to pull the seniority card on the field after Hoke has handled himself very well. Once Bragg takes command, unfortunately, Confederate misfortunes start to mount, and they're eventually forced to withdraw back to Smithfield. Yes, sir.
You mentioned the state of the Bentonville battlefield. I was wondering about the Averysboro battle.
Same. Looks much as it did today. Mm-hmm. There's a museum there, as there is at Bentonville. It's privately run. It's a very nice museum. They have a number of very nice relics. There are three major plantation houses that were on the battlefield, or near the battlefield, give or take. Those are still standing, although they are private property. It's in both battlefields are very well preserved.
When Lee was, he became the overall general of the Confederacy, on what date?
January, February of 65.
So he, is he in coordination with, because with Johnston, I know he tried to break out and hook up with Early, and that's how he got stuck in Appomattox, but was there any thought of him just breaking those lines at Petersburg and trying to hook up with Johnston's forces?
Eventually.
Are they just too far apart?
Eventually. They're not necessarily as far apart. That's something that Lee's been toying with. By the time he gets to March 65 rolls around, he's toying with the idea of breaking out of Petersburg, feigning a major attack on the Union lines, and swinging out to the south to join Johnston in North Carolina.
Because at this time in their mindset, they still believe that they're a fighting force.
Yes.
The surrender business is far from
their
mind.
It hasn't happened.
Was it in Johnston's mind after this battle?
Not yet. Johnston's going to start thinking more along those lines once he receives word of Lee's surrender. And once Lee goes, Johnston's a realist. He knows that he's not going to be able to hold on. It's interesting, though, that he has a several-day head start on Sherman's armies. Sherman never really catches up to him. But it is something that after Lee surrenders, that pushes Johnston to begin to make that approach to Jefferson Davis, say it's time to stop fighting. Yes, sir.
That's kind of a segue into my question. Is what did they do? What was going on between the two commanders or two armies between the end of this battle and, let's say, when they surrendered? Because they actually surrendered like April 20-something.
Yeah, April 26th.
Yep. I remember that correctly. And then the second part is, wasn't McClaw sent home after this?
I believe McClaws is still with the army.
Okay.
Because he does eventually get pulled out from his position on the Confederate left. He does take part in the assaults on the Morris Farm line later in the day. Get back to your first question. Sherman continues to Goldsboro. He gets on a railroad car, goes down to New Bern, gets on a ship, and comes up to City Point to meet with Admiral David Porter, General Grant, President Lincoln, and Phil Sheridan, General Sheridan. They discuss the plans for the final days of the war, or how they're going to close out the spring campaign, if you will. The war hasn't ended yet. Sherman returns to Goldsboro. The army's there for a few weeks, and he sets out early April. And he does a couple of things. One is that he takes Joseph Maurer and promotes him over Alpheus Williams to command the 20th Corps in the Army of Georgia. So as much as Sherman was irritated with Maurer, he puts him in Corps command, which means that Sherman's fully expecting to have. He's expecting to fight another battle. He's moving officers around. He initially begins marching north with the idea of coming into Virginia and cutting off that last rail line, moving into Petersburg. But Phil Sheridan beats him to the punch at Five Forks. Once
the south side, I guess.
Yes. And once Sherman receives word that Richmond and Petersburg have fallen, he turns west and goes after Johnston's army. He's actually in Smithfield, the site of the Confederate concentration, when he receives word of Lee's surrender at Appomattox. Johnston is going to march toward Raleigh, pass through Raleigh. The Confederates are going to, begin hearing rumors of Lee's surrender before it's confirmed, and then they are going to start seeing men from Lee's army passing back into North Carolina on their way home to confirm that word. And Johnston and a number of Davis's advisors will eventually just tell Davis, it's enough is enough. Lee's army has surrendered. They were our heart and soul. We need to get terms now. And eventually they do meet at Bennett House, and Johnston will eventually surrender what becomes the largest Confederate surrender of the war, because Johnston's a department commander. His department encapsulates the Carolinas, Georgia, and Florida. He surrenders not only just his army, but also another 68,000, 69,000 men.
I was familiar with the you know, the controversy on Sherman and the terms.
Sure.
But I was kind of a little less clear on, you know, what happened between like point A and point B, I guess.
They're marching across North Carolina. But the terms are something that Sherman goes into the Bennett House on the first day with the knowledge that Abraham Lincoln's been assassinated. He also goes into the Bennett House with the knowledge that once word gets out to the Union armies who are in around Raleigh, officers are going to lose command of control. And Sherman makes a giant leap that he probably, I can understand why he made it, probably shouldn't have. He made it based on his understanding of the situation, and offers very generous terms to Johnston and his army. Yes, sir.
When you say that Sherman was waiting to hear back from his commander, how do they actually communicate? Cause, I mean,
By courier. Yes. Actually, during the battle?
Yeah. I mean, you're saying he stopped the wind before he turned north.
Yeah. During the battle or after? After the battle,
how does he hear from Sherman?
Grant?
Yeah.
Telegram.
Yeah. How do they hear from
Telegram? They're exchanging letters. During the march through Georgia, as Sherman gets closer to the coast, Grant's starting to send down his staff officers via the Union Navy to come up and make contact and bring letters to Grant. Same thing. They're writing prolifically back and forth while the armies are in Savannah. They continue writing by letter. Grant and Sherman do. Up until the time that they meet in late March at City Point. During the actual battle, Sherman and Slocum are communicating via courier. And Slocum sends, after he receives word that Johnston's army is right in front of him, he sends a number of couriers to Sherman, alerting him of the news.
I'm guessing that's a dangerous job, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no fortunately. Exactly. Send a staff officer. Slocum is telling his couriers to keep well far away from our right flank. So keep well away to the south to find Sherman and the Army of the Tennessee, because he doesn't know what's lurking to the south, if they're going to be intercepted by Confederate cavalry. He's been engaging Confederate cavalry all morning on the first day. Yes, sir.
Did Johnston know the circumstances of President Jefferson Davis on the 26th of April?
Yes.
It was a covert operation that was with 3,000 cavalrymen that were heading for Washington, Georgia.
Right. Davis leaves Johnston and several other generals. Also, John C. Breckinridge, then Secretary of War, to make the final surrender and work out the final terms. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, well, like I said, that's the curious word, like my grandfather was on the last covert commission of the general in Breckinridge. So, and he said they got to Washington, Georgia on May 5th. They had they issued 3,000 cavalrymen, $26 of silver. And basically, like I said, it was a mission that could have been gone wrong.
Oh, sure.
So, like I said, it was, and yet on the 26th, when you surrender your whole forces south of what you just said, they technically all should surrender at the same time.
Technically, not a lot of the men do. A lot of the Confederates by that point in time. There are men of the Army of Tennessee who just leave. They know the war's over. There's nothing left to fight for. They just start going home.
Yeah, well, like I said, mine surrendered 30 days after Lee, so in Washington, Georgia. Mm-hmm. Well,
just a two-part question.
Sure.
I know in my history, the state government of North Carolina was very unfriendly terms with the Confederate National Government.
Yep.
And did that play any role in sparing of North Carolina in terms of as compared to Georgia and South Carolina?
Sure. It does. It does. To a certain degree. Raleigh is saved much through the efforts of Governor Zebulon Vance, who, aside from Jefferson Davis, decides to send out his own emissaries, if you will, to the Federal Army to begin negotiating, at least for not the Confederate, obviously the surrender of Johnson's army, but for the surrender of the city of Raleigh. They don't want it sacked. Georgia, the march through Georgia and South Carolina are a little bit different. South Carolina obviously gets it worse than Georgia gets it, because South Carolina is where the war started. And a lot of the federal soldiers see friends and relatives killed over the course of the war, and they peg it back to South Carolina being the first state to secede. South Carolina gets it worse than Georgia, at least in my estimation.
How about one more question?
Sure.
Is your book going to be up on Kindle?
It should be. A lot of Savas Beattie's publications go up on Kindle.
That's a very good point. We can end
that's
with that.
That's an excellent point.
Something for you. It's one of our mugs, and
thank you very much.
That always is actually made by a pottery shop out.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
His books are in the back, and also his
book. What's the name of your book?
Calamity in Carolina: Battles of Amesbury and Bentonville.
Drive carefully. See you next month.
Yes, sir. Yes, it is. She's going to have a book coming out later in the spring called The Aftermath of the Battle. And one of the chapters specifically deals with Dr. Letterman.
I haven't been down to the Bentonville Amherst borough area for about 2 years. I was wondering, I know, you know, Amherstboro is finally getting its act together from the last time I was down there doing something. But now that the ballpark is no longer at Weiss Fork, is North Carolina doing anything on the Weiss Fork front?
That's an excellent question. That's a really good question. I don't know. When I went through there back in October, it did not look like they were doing it.
Okay.
But that's a good question.
Yeah, the only reason I knew that if the ballpark was there was because, you know, when my son was teaching at ECU, we'd go down and catch the Indian games, and you know, right there, that's where the historical marker is. Yeah. If you're going into the ballpark, where the Kinston Indians played. Yep. You know. So,
Bentonville is actually expanding. They're in the process of adding at least 3 new tour stops in Silas, which is great. They're actually going to, they're hoping at some point in the near future to put in a trail from the visitor center out to those earthworks that I showed you all a picture of. That's about a mile and a half round trip.
I was amazed at how much they had done to the place when I was down there 2 years ago compared to what it was like when I was down there for the 125th.
Yeah,
it was.
They've done a magnificent job.
Yeah.
It's a really nice place to go.
One of the few pristine parks
here. It is. It really
that
is.
And Shiloh are the two best.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And Chickamauga, too.
Chickamauga is very well.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
Yes, sir. My apologies.
Like I said, you'll get a free advertisement. Get that.
I'll let you know. I do appreciate it.
Love to have you sign it.
I'd be happy to sign
it. It's a great lecture.
Thank you.